Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Elledge, and this is Skylines, the Cinemetric podcast. Something we've kind of touched on in this podcast occasionally is the role culture plays in cities, and particularly in economic development. It's obviously been a huge factor in the regeneration of certain cities. When Liverpool was European capital of culture, that's widely seen as having revived the city. I think the other famous example is probably the Spanish city of Bilbao, where having the Guggenheim open a rather fine gallery of a massive dog made of flowers outside has been excellent for that particular city. But we've kind of never really delved into that in huge amounts of depth. So that's what we're going to do today. And to do that, I'm joined by someone who's been looking into this exact subject. Do you want to tell me who you are?
Sure. I'm Carolina Saludas. I am the co-chair of the Arts and Culture Network at the Young Fabians. Very long-winded title. From the Fabian Society. So we are a progressive think tank, and we look into policy development, policy lobbying, research publication, that kind of thing.
Okay. And just because someone was asking me this yesterday, how young are the Young Fabians?
Not very young. The answer. It's for under 31s, which make us on the closer edge of 31 feel good about ourselves.
That's almost reassuring. Like, it's, don't get me wrong, still not young enough to be a young Fabian, but it's not as far out of reach as I imagined it would be. So there's something.
Absolutely.
Okay, so first question. We're looking at culture-led regeneration. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
So there are a lot of definitions out there. So to give a very brief outline, there have been many studies on what culture means, what regeneration means, and then obviously what culture-led regeneration means. So in terms of regeneration as a whole, it's been a bit of a catch-all term since the 80s to mean a use of public land, sometimes mixed with private land, to do something better for a community and for the aesthetic of a city. So it has those two elements to it. And then culture, it can mean a lot of things, and it really depends on what report and what organization is talking to you about it. So it could be design of a city, it could be architecture, it could be art festivals, it could be really small community-led projects about arts education. So it encompasses a lot of things, and it really depends who is paying as to what they cover. And in terms of culture-led regeneration itself, again, it has those two elements. It has the aesthetic element, so for example, the Bilbao example that you talked about, Newcastle, Liverpool, Hull, there's many in the UK that we can recognise as having been culturally regenerated for the museums, the public plazas, etc. And then there's the kind of deeper, more difficult socio-urban quality of life element to it. So how do you empower communities? How do you integrate communities? A lot of cultural regeneration has been used as a bit of a tool to talk about migration, for example, to talk about much more difficult subjects, economic regeneration of a region, for example. So it can mean a lot of things, but broadly it has both the aesthetic, what it looks like, and then what it's actually doing for a community.
Okay, I kind of started in on economics. Is that too narrow an idea of what? Like, can you have regeneration that isn't about a city getting richer, basically?
I think the investment part of it is so fundamental to being able to do stuff that in almost every research paper I've read, it features broadly. But what is also mentioned again and again is that you can't really solve cultural problems. You can't use culture as a tool for regeneration if you don't have leadership and if you don't have coordination. So, for example, there was a really interesting study by the Cultural Cities Research Network some years ago looking at cities that had bid for the City of Culture program. And they discovered that just by bidding, just by getting together and working out a plan for regeneration to bid for this program, they were already making progress in their cultural strategy, right? So just the getting together and organizing was already really helpful. Now, the biggest impediment to then being able to produce a result, to have an impact, was the fact that they found it really hard to coordinate with other national and regional organizations in order to implement these plans, right? So the money is really important, but if you can't coordinate between really, really wide different areas, then it's almost impossible to actually do.
Mm. Now, the point about how you don't even need to actually necessarily win one of these festivals or whatever it is, win the right to host them, one of these festivals, is an interesting one. Because a couple of years ago, I was up in Paisley, which is a town in Scotland, in the western suburbs of Glasgow, which is effectively a part of Greater Glasgow. And everyone I was speaking to there about their bid to be UK capital of culture was talking about how even, you know, just the act of putting together a bid had kind of made them rethink the use of public space and what assets they had.
That's amazing.
And, you know, just like it kind of forced all these people to get around a table, I think, was the...
Absolutely. And one thing that I am finding very surprising in my role in the Young Favians is that culture is both incredibly important. It cuts across almost every single policy area, a little bit like environmental policy, you know, it kind of touches everything. But it's because it's very wide, it's almost always not thought about properly within a project. It seems to be a happy afterthought, a happy after effect outside of the very clear boundaries of, you know, DCMS and Arts Council England. So it is bizarre that, particularly for local governments, the moment there is some thought put into culture, there's immediately an advantage. I think it's probably low-hanging fruit.
Also, it's an area that's borne the brunt of austerity, right? It's not, you know, at a point where council budgets are being cut by 20, 30, 40%.
Yeah.
Your culture budget is one of the first things to go because you've got to stop old people from starving and kids being abused. At the most basic level, that is what we're talking about.
We're getting into the cheery part of the podcast.
or like to be slightly less depressing about it, like people are going to complain if the bins don't get emptied a long time before they're going to complain if the performing arts festival
Absolutely.
Happen.
One of the things that's really hard about cultural regeneration is that it's inherently long-term, and things that are inherently long-term and difficult to quantify are really both not sexy and hard to sell and hard to prove after the fact. So one of the things that one of the studies has found is that the lack of local government funding for culture, I mean, in general, which has led to lower investment in culture, has then forced local governments to seek private partnerships in order to provide those cultural events and that provision. The problem is only places that have got the people and the resources and maybe the interesting, you know, national heritage sites and so on already within their borders are able to have that, to have those programs. So in the end, you end up with kind of cultural inequality between regions that can't really afford and don't have the bandwidth at the time to think about culture. And then the ones that do, that probably already did before, and now just get a bit nicer cut of the pie, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so there is this thing called the Bilbao effect, right? Which is, you know, Bilbao is kind of the classic example of this, is a city that's, you know, a post-industrial city in northern Spain, has turned into a massive tourism destination, largely because of, like, although the Guggenheim is only one gallery, it kind of woke people up to the fact that this is actually a really cool place. Like, there's loads going for it.
Great food.
Yeah. And it's an absolutely magnificent place. Like, I went there a couple of years ago, and the drive in from the airport, you kind of go into a tunnel under a mountain, and you come out, and the city is just laid out below you in this valley. Yeah. And it's just, you know, physically, it's this incredible place. And in a different way, like, you know, cultural regeneration has done great things for Liverpool. Again, there's a city with a lot going for it. It's got beautiful architecture, like, it's got this amazing cultural history. These are not necessarily things you can just transfer to anywhere else. So, like, to what extent do you need to kind of be in quite a good position for this to work in the first place?
So there's a really interesting case. Now, I can't remember who did this research. Phone in. Sorry, not phone in. Email us if you can remember. They did a long time series piece of research on Olympic Games and Olympic Games bids, and then the after effect on cities that had successfully bid and hosted the Olympics. One thing that they found, which was really quite sad, is that the cities that have done the best out of the Olympics, London being one of them, Tokyo looks likely to do really well out of it, is that they already have the infrastructure in place in order to allocate the resources, make the most of them, utilize the spaces afterwards. So a city like Athens, which was about to get into the worst recession it had ever seen, wasn't able to manage its resources very well. And actually, the city hasn't done very well out of it. It's in a hole of debt. And if you go to Athens, it's really sad because the Olympic grounds are basically abandoned. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think some parts are now being used. But if you go, it's just largely like beautiful white buildings. Yeah, they're completely unused.
There are amazing photo stories, I think, in the run-up to London 2012, looking at what happened to the Athens sites. Yeah. They're just abandoned. But yeah. I think also geography is a factor there. Like, one of the reasons the London Olympics kind of worked in terms of regenerating a chunk of the city is it was just this kind of hole in East London between populated areas.
Yeah.
And if you could find an excuse to clean it up, that area was always going to be fine. Whereas, as I understand it, what they did in Athens was they built this kind of Olympic park on the edge of town, miles from anywhere.
Yeah.
That's not in a place where it's going to naturally be useful in the same way.
Yeah, there's just like one tube line that connects it. Either you go there to see this thing. But there was no bigger plan in place. There was no LLDC like Stratford has, right? So the Olympics now has a program uniquely dedicated to community links in Stratford to use the facilities that were left behind after the Olympics. None of that was really able to be done, neither in Athens, South Africa, Brazil. Like, there are many examples from big sporting events that just haven't really had the time or the money or the bandwidth in local government to look into it. So ironically, the places that do really well are places that were already a little bit underrated. So Barcelona is always hailed as that example of city that did so well. But Barcelona was already a very industrial place. And in the same way as London, it had an area that it really needed to regenerate. They used the plan very effectively with really good urban design and with really strong community links. And they've carried doing that for the next, 25 to 30 years. So in a sense, it's kind of unsurprising, in the same way that for London, it's kind of unsurprising that they did well, because we have a very long tradition of, we've hosted the Olympic Games before. So we collectively kind of know how to do it. So yeah, ironically, the big sporting events, they benefit the ones that are already doing it really well.
Well, the incredible thing about Barcelona's 92 Olympics is before them, despite it being the largest city on the shores of the Mediterranean, it didn't really have a beach. Like, it just totally ignored its waterfront. It was just this kind of industrial area.
Yeah.
And the Olympics kind of forced the city to kind of sort it out. And now it's, one of the most popular tourism destinations in Europe.
It's so pretty. I can't even. My sister lives in Barcelona. And I'm so jealous of her. She has a great life. But so my mum grew up in Barcelona. And she still marvels. Like, she'll go through a neighborhood and she'll be like, this used to be a dive. Like, no one would come here. And now it's this beautiful regenerated area. And I think it's because they have taken that model of picking an area that needs regeneration and linking it across with loads of different organizations. So I think that is what the places that have done it really well always have. I think Berlin's, for example, doing some really interesting stuff. So they shut down Tempelhof Airport and now they're rejigging it and, rebuilding it. It also really helps if your land is worth a lot of money, right? So Stratford had the potential to be really expensive flats really quickly. Berlin's property market's going through the roof. Barcelona was the same. Bilbao was the same. So yeah, looking at the economics of what fuels urban regeneration is also quite an interesting thing, one that a lot of cultural organizations don't like to think about very much. But
please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news, ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, so you know the drill by now. I am here at the Centre for Cities Fine Offices in the London Bridge District of London, which is a very originally named district, which isn't even on a bridge. I don't know why I see this ridiculous city. But today we are privileged because we actually have, we have the boss. We have Andrew Carter with us for a change. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm very good. I'm very good. Sun is shining.
It's beautiful out. I assume you've locked Paul Swinney in a cupboard for the duration.
We have. He's had far too much exposure. He's getting very excited.
He's getting above himself, isn't he?
Indeed. Yeah. We have to bring him down a peg or two. So he's in the cupboard, and if with good behaviour, he'll be out shortly.
Excellent. I should say we're recording this a couple of weeks in advance of publication. It's 1st of July 4th as we speak, so it's possible we're going to make some assumptions about the Conservative leadership race that do not hold true. But at time of recording, it looks fairly likely that Boris Johnson is going to be the next Prime Minister, with a slim chance it might be Jeremy Hunt. Of course, there's also a slim chance the next Tory leader is not the next Prime Minister, but we'll put that to one side for now. We are going to talk about what the next Prime Minister can do for Britain's cities and the people who live within them, which is an issue you've been giving quite a lot of thought to, isn't it, Andrew?
We have. We've been thinking about it. Interestingly, you know, he will be, if it's Johnson, as you say, you know, he will be a former mayor, which is much more of a kind of usual experience in other countries, but the first time here where a former mayor could well be the next Prime Minister. So it'll be interesting to see, in fact, in kind of more general sense, as to how much of what he was espousing while he was the Mayor of London follows him to number 10 question, you know, the answer to which we will find out.
So the obvious first question here is, what do we think Boris Johnson was espousing when he was Mayor of London? Because as someone who wrote a lot about the Johnson mayoralty, I'm not entirely sure, if I'm honest with you. He seemed to like, he had a thing about bridges. He likes sort of big physical monuments to his achievements in life. He didn't seem that sort of infused about any particular aspect of policy.
Well, that's probably fair. Although I think he was, you know, he was an advocate for London and he was an advocate for cities. So I think that's the first thing that we would hope follows him through, a kind of recognition of the significance of the cities and, you know, London, but cities more generally within the national situation. So, you know, on the economy, you know, they are the hubs, etc. And so I think that's the first thing that we would hope, if he becomes Prime Minister, he takes with him into number 10, is a recognition of where a lot of growth happens and the need to get more of our cities, actually more of our cities outside of London and the Greater Southeast, performing better than they currently are. So that would be the first thing that I would be really hoping that he takes with him. The second thing I think we would definitely want him to be doing and addressing, again, from his time there, is to address and reverse some of the stringent reductions in money that have gone into local government in general, you know, but our urban local government in particular. So we'd want to see him think about how, you know, the funding that goes into local government and urban local government in particular gets reversed either through the immediate emergency budget that he's been talking about, or if and when we have it, the spending review, which will either be a 1 year or maybe will continue to be a 3 year, but I think probably 1 year.
Okay, well, let's take those in reverse order. On the spending thing, there are already signs that both candidates for the Tory leadership have located the magic money tree and are preparing to harvest quite enthusiastically, which, to be fair, does make a certain amount of sense, in that austerity was always meant to be a reasonably like contained thing. In, you know, 9 years after the Tories re-entered government, I don't think anyone expected that we'd still be sort of talking about shrinking the state.
No.
So that's not a crazy idea, and it will also probably be quite popular. On the other point, though, I'm not sold on the idea that he really sort of represents urban Britain in a number of ways. I mean, firstly, his constituency is, what's it, Uxbridge?
Uxbridge.
South Ruislip?
Yeah.
Which is...
good part of West London, you know, close to the airport.
Zone 6, it's right on the edge of London.
Yeah.
It is an area that just about voted Leave, I believe. Or Hillingdon, the borough it's in as a whole, voted Leave, certainly. So it is one of those kind of like outer London suburbs that in some ways is not that London-y. But more to the point, like, he has kind of shifted position quite a lot. Like, there was the... firstly, the fact that he came out for leaving the European Union at all, which is very much not the position of London as a whole.
Indeed not.
And secondly, there was the line he used, which I think went, fuck business.
Yes.
Which is not really in line with either sort of historic Tory party strategy or with his own position as Mayor of London. So, I mean, can we necessarily read across from the fact that he was a mayor to think he cares about cities? Is it at all possible that he mostly cares about Boris?
It's possible. Whether it's probable, you know, I think you're right. But, I'm a bit of a believer, I think, in, you know, the discipline of power. And that once he's in, if he's in government, then particularly, you know, as you look at the economy, you know, worries today, worries now around, are we slipping towards a kind of mild recession even before October the 31st? But certainly concerns around stagnant wages, low productivity, you know, in a sense, those issues have not gone away. And they will be very, very relevant and pertinent for the new Prime Minister. If you want to spend more money, you've got to raise it. And one of the ways to raise it is to grow the overall size of the economy. And so thinking about how that, you know, the magic money tree and the proceeds from it get allocated into infrastructure, into skills, into innovation, much of which is urban, but not all of it. And really kind of thinking about how we get the economy functioning more effectively than it is. I think that is and will be an issue that he'll need to grapple with. So the discipline of that gives me some confidence, how much is debatable, that he will take some of what he thought about and advocated for when he was mayor into number 10. The second thing is, and go back to your first previous point, my point about funding, you know, he was the mayor who brought back together, as it were, the London Finance Commission that was originally set up and reported under Livingstone. He then brought it back under Tony Travers to look again at the devolution, the fiscal responsibilities, the fiscal autonomy that he wanted London to have in order to, you know, to fund its own development over a period. You know, he did that. He was a pretty bold advocate for the findings of that. So hopefully, you know, again, when he gets to number 10, he reminds himself of that document and then begins to re-energize the devolution debate, which has kind of gone moribund, I suppose, over the last couple of years.
Has he shown any particular interest in devolution, do you think? I mean,
Well, he did when he was under mayor, didn't he?
But is that not a subset of him showing an interest in his own power and prospects?
Well, you know, so, I mean, motivations vary. I mean, ultimately, I'm less worried about his motivation, I suppose. I'm more worried about the outcomes of it. If, you know, if his motivation is his own self-aggrandizement, then fine. If he gives more devolution to cities as a way to do that and be seen as, you know, the great devolving prime minister, then, you know, that will be a good outcome.
I mean, I do sometimes worry a little that, like, I love you guys, I love your policy agenda, but I do sometimes feel it's a bit like talking to a vicar. Where, like, whatever you're talking to, like, the lesson turns out to be Jesus. Whatever the topic of conversation, like, the lesson is the importance of fiscal devolution. But I guess what I'm sort of, like, I've wondered for a while if actually there will be, at some point we'll get to a point where there is an incentive on a Prime Minister or a Chancellor to, just as George Osborne famously devolved the axe, to devolve the tax rises, because at some point we are going to need more money to fund local government, because otherwise stuff is going to fall over. If the national government wants deniability around that, does it make sense for them to actually start devolving some fiscal powers so that, like, it's local government that gets in trouble for raising taxes?
Always better place to make the arguments as to why the taxes need to be raised. You know, I think there is good evidence, not only from here, you know, in small ways. Look at the evolution that we had around business improvement districts. You know, people said, only asking businesses to pay an extra penny in the pound for services that they regard to be, you know, public services, extra street cleaning, extra community safety stuff, that will never wash, actually proven to be completely the reverse. Businesses across the country in prosperous places and indeed in less prosperous places have introduced bids because of the connection between the money raised and what it gets spent on. And I think when you look at kind of local tax raising, whether it may be, you know, hotel taxes in Edinburgh or Birmingham or something like that, or kind of extra pennies in the pound to, you know, to redevelop certain areas or to improve transport infrastructure, I think the arguments there and the evidence there seems to say that, you know, we have, that's a better way to go. I'm not saying, you know, that's the only thing we should be thinking about, but I do feel more confident that, you know, in that sort of scenario, the connection between money raised and money spent in a kind of localized sense actually will empower places and indeed empower the citizens of those places to be more mindful, more engaged in those sorts of issues. So I'm kind of mildly optimistic on those things. I think people often become, you know, reluctant on tax increases because it's like, well, where does this go? Mm. It kind of disappears into the, you know, into the ether, and it never quite returns. What am I paying my taxes for? Well, we know that, you know, at the local level, people can see very clearly, or could see more clearly, what they, you know, what their monies will be, you know, will be spent on.
We should at least glance at Jeremy Hunt. There are technically two candidates in the race. Jeremy Hunt does exist. Do you have any sort of strong impulses about where he might stand on some of these issues, whether he is thinking about urban policy at all?
I have a much less of a sense as to him, although, interestingly, he has come out, I think he came out a couple of days ago or so, in the very beginnings of July, making some warm noises about the Northern Powerhouse and the kind of reinvigoration of, I think. So I think he's aware of these sorts of issues. I don't think it's his natural terrain, but interestingly, you know, he was the health minister, you know, and he has said something again recently around, you know, the issues around social care, which do play out and are very significant for places across the country. You know, many, many local authorities now spending more than 50% of their budgets on social care. If funding remained static, demand, you know, continues to increase. So in some respects, you know, questions and issues like that will also have quite large effects on places up and down the country, and indeed, you know, asks the question about what our local authorities are for outside of, you know, delivering social care, whether it's adult or children. So I think, you know, he may not be thinking directly about urban policy, but some of the issues he's beginning to talk about very directly influence urban areas.
Well, it's a time of great change in British politics. Like, we sort of, it's sort of weird because in some ways we know exactly where we're going to be in a couple of months' time. And in some ways, everything kind of feels it's entirely open. We can probably make a good guess as to who's going to be prime minister and that we still won't have a Brexit policy to speak of. But on the other hand, it does kind of feel like a lot of these issues are going to start coming to a head soon. And that will force change that perhaps wouldn't have been forthcoming otherwise.
Absolutely. You know, in a sense, if you think about, in a sense, when Theresa May became prime minister, yes, Brexit was the issue that she was obviously going to need to address. But she also then said she would address a bunch of other issues. In reality, Brexit has consumed her premiership and is obviously unresolved by the time she finishes. The question will be whether the new prime minister allows or enables or encourages a same process, because Brexit will need to be dealt with, and it's the big, you know, it's the biggest issue. It's the extent to which the prime minister, whether it's Johnson or Hunt, is also then being prepared to be proactive on a whole range of domestic policy agendas, whether it's issues to do with skills or education or transport or housing and social care, for example. All of those need dealing with. And I don't think, you know, another 3 years or another, you know, 2 years of doing very little on the domestic agenda is going to be feasible.
Well, as someone who writes and podcasts a lot about public policy, I think we can say these are exciting times.
They are. Very true.
Thank you, Andrew.
Pleasure.
Okay, so we've talked about some success stories. Let's go to the other end of the scale. Where hasn't this worked and why?
So I'm not going to point fingers because I'm nice. All cities are great. However.
Oh, come on. Like, getting letters is the fun part.
Yeah, exactly. So the famous ones that haven't really worked, again, we talked about Athens, an unfortunate case. Montreal in 68 wasn't a great host of Olympic Games, unfortunately. Rio, for example, held the World Cup and another massive sporting event that's now...
The Olympics, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And all within a couple of years of each other. Now, they knew that this was a very ambitious project, but I don't think, and the consensus is they didn't really manage to not even touch the surface of the problems that the city has and the country has. And you could argue that they could have spent the money in other things. Now, one really interesting piece of research regarding what constitutes success for regeneration projects is the approach to it. So, again, not to point fingers, but New Labour had a very kind of homogenous, centralised, close strategy on culture-led regeneration. They figured out that they could use culture as a tool, as a direct outcome-led tool for regeneration, which is really great. But sometimes it came out in projects that wouldn't really be that important for the community or wouldn't be that relevant, or they just wouldn't really talk to the different communities in a place. So they kind of lacked that diversity. So if you remember late 90s, early noughties, all of those kind of samey, kind of hygienic-looking plazas all around Europe that came out, you know, I'm thinking of like the Reichstag development. Mm-hmm. They all looked great, but you could have taken the pictures and put them in different places and they would have all looked the same. You would have known which one was which. There's a really nice quote from Phil Redwood, who is very big in this area, talking about how he spoke to this kid in this area, and they were talking about sports facilities, and the kid was like, I don't understand. You guys spend 30 million developing this big sports center, but before we had 20 not great looking football pitches, but now we have one and an Olympic swimming pool, which we don't need. And now it's a very glitzy football pitch, but you have to pay for it. So somebody should have come and asked us what we needed. So that's kind of an example of when it doesn't work.
So is the lesson here that it sort of needs to be done with the community rather than to the community?
Exactly. The problem, of course, is that when it comes to it, it's really hard to actually do, right? So you will have, for example, the Local Government Association commissioned a report last year that came out this year, which was really good, but pointed to the practicalities of doing something like this. When you haven't even put together a bid, how do you get together and do big, expensive consultations? You know, that you want to have a managed approach, right? So you kind of want to keep your cards close to your chest. And also, it's really hard to entice people when the thing hasn't been won. So their approach is, well, we will engage the community once the bid has been won, and then we'll make it how we want to make it. But sometimes a lot of things have already been decided by the time you get to that. And so people feel like, well, you know, you can consult us, but you've already planned the big sporting centre and whatever, and this big festival that nobody needed.
We're talking a lot about sport. What about kind of other forms of culture? Like, does that work differently, or is it the same problem?
Same problem. So you will have big things that we talked about. So big architecture projects, big urban design projects, which are slightly different but kind of the same. So if you say take a beautiful square that is not looking very nice, and you kind of redo the whole strategy around it, landscape it, all that sort of stuff. So that counts also as cultural regeneration because it creates a space for culture and interaction. There's things like festivals, for example. The London Borough of Culture project has been very good with that. So Walthamstow is now hosting festivals, street parties, you know, opening up and losing up the licenses, for example. So there's a lot that can be done locally that is much more ingrained in the community, right? Much more community-led. There are big sculpture projects like Anthony Gormley's. There can even be things like film documentary projects. So it can really span quite a lot of things. And there's a lot on arts education as well. So how do you teach communities about their own history, their own past, and reinforce a sense of place and togetherness?
So something we haven't really talked about is, you know, where does EU money fit into all this? Because, you know, the EU has historically been a great funder of this sort of project. Mm. Although, like, nothing is certain in British politics these days, there is a fair chance the EU is not going to continue being a big funder of this stuff in a British context. How big a problem is that?
So, currently, the EU has set out through the European Commission a strategic plan between 2019 and 2024, where they have highlighted the key areas of policy development, one of which is culture, because they have figured out that actually social cohesion is really important at a time when that's very much put at doubt. That has informed a lot of things about where money is going to be funneled. But even beyond that, the European Union has been very good, particularly with the UK, in spite of what many politicians will say, at funding development. So there's this thing which some of you will have heard of called the European Regional Development Plan, which a lot of UK cities, in fact most UK cities, have benefited from, which is meant to help develop parts of different countries. So, for example, in the UK, Cornwall has received a lot of money for this kind of development. Wales has received a lot of funding for this kind of development. And to them, there are kind of four legs to this. There's the environmental stuff, which is really important, really key. There's the spatial strategy, so what gets put into what, right? So, and that has a lot to do with quality of life. You know, so many spaces need to be for community centres, so many spaces need to be for schools, so on and so forth. They will try to have a say in that or inform a say in that. There's the aesthetic, so through the use of architects that they use for various programs, which inform how cities look. And then, of course, there's the economic part of it, which is just direct funding of organizations. So they have a big say, and without sounding political, not having that will have a very direct impact on how people live their lives here.
It is not obvious to me, given the history of British governments, particularly Tory-led British governments, that places like Cornwall or rural Wales are going to see this funding replaced from national government. It just doesn't really seem to me like the sort of thing that
no.
the government is going to do.
No, they favour private-public partnerships, keeping the government, particularly local government, small and, to their mind, nimble. But of course, as we said before, what that means is regional inequality. It means some cities will get loads of cash because they will be able to attract loads of cash. Think southeast of England, London, of course, maybe Edinburgh, maybe Glasgow. And then the rest of the places that will struggle will just not be able to attract funding. And if they don't, they just won't have the public help that they are currently getting.
So is cultural regeneration going to be a thing that sort of happened for a period in British politics that we're maybe now sort of seeing winding down? Maybe this isn't going to be a huge thing in future.
So there's a glimmer of hope, which is that many organisations do this. So you've got your, as we mentioned, the Local Government Association, which has, again, different parties going into it. You've got DCMS, so the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, which sets up big kind of nationwide strategies. You've got the Arts Council England. And all of these function relatively independent. They try to coordinate between each other, but they try to cover different areas from the very specific to the very global. So there's hope that if one party is in government, they won't be able to completely defund the arts. But unfortunately, the other way around also works. If you have suddenly a very progressive, very pro-culture government, it might not suddenly mean that a lot of money is going to be put into culture.
Oh, well, a glimmer of hope is you know, still a nice note to end on, so we'll leave it there. Carolina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and recorded by me, John Anidge, and produced by Nick Hilton. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on iTunes, Acast, or whatever other app you use to get your podcast. And while you're there, why not leave us a nice review to tell other people we're here? It, you know, it really helps people discover the show, and I'm a megalomaniac, so the more people I can get listening to this, the better, really. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.